It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Do you believe in ghosts?
First simply disappears, the other two died.
Hello, hello, my pretties. It's your criminal researcher and host, Ashley Lana. I hope you're doing wonderful. I am fantastic. And if you are wondering why this episode was dropped on a Thursday and not its usual every 2 weeks on a Monday, I faced a podcaster's worst nightmare. My fellow podcasters, if you are listening, it happened. While I was recording, my professional mic disconnected without my knowledge, and it quickly reconnected to my computer's internal mic. So what this gave me was basically tin can and string from Jupiter sound, and it was, well, obviously it was awful. I had to re-record. I wasn't going to give that to you, Fear Cult, so I had to go back, re-record, but here we are. We are present and accounted for, adept and overcome, Fear Cult, ready for a new case. With that being said, welcome to Lullaby. Last episode, I talked about the Romanian vampire serial killer, Ion Romaru, the Butcher of Bucharest, who went down as one of the most horrendous criminals on Earth. Almost every single one of his crimes had a witness, yet no one reached out. And the media never wanted to cover the case because criminals like that just didn't exist at that time. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, push off a cliff, shit like that. This week, I'm going to be examining a case that was news to me. And that was shocking because it's an older case. It's a Canadian case. So when I read the case file, I moved it to the top of my research list. And now I'm presenting it to you, the Fear Cult, tonight. Tonight's case involves children. And I'm aware these cases may be more difficult for parents to listen to. That is why I am announcing the topic now. My sources for this episode include published news articles from the Canadian Broadcasting Center, the Global News, Sandy Charles court transcripts, eyewitness accounts, as well as the novel Kids Who Kill, written by true crime author Catherine McMaster. This will leave you in awe of what a child is capable of. So get comfortable, because sweet dreams are made of these. The following case contains mature subject matter, involving graphic descriptions of mental illness, assault, body desecration, race, and murder. Please take into consideration that not all topics are suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised. Sandy Charles was born on July 16, 1981, in the small town of LaRonge, Saskatchewan, Canada. This picturesque town lies adjacent to the Lac La Ronge Provincial Park, offering beautiful views of the boreal forest that encompasses the Treaty 6 Indigenous Crown Land. Sandy is the eldest of three siblings, born to his mother, Jean Charles, when she was just 17 years old. Both his younger sister and brother have different fathers, but they were all raised by Jean, and occasionally their grandparents, on the northern Saskatchewan trapline. This trapline, belonging to the First Nations Cree, where traditional practices like hunting, fishing, and trapping are carried out. Tragically, Sandy's father passed away before he could share the joy of fishing with his children on the land. He lost his life in December 1984, a victim of a drunk driver. This loss led to Sandy being diagnosed with schizophrenia at age 3, after the voices in his head developed after the death of his father. His mother, Jean, was described as a neglectful yet hardworking single mother who was frequently absent from her children's lives due to her multiple jobs. To support her children, Jean worked various restaurants and bars around town, her shifts extending from day till late in the night. This left her three kids, including Sandy, often unsupervised and alone for long hours. Assuming the role of a caregiver, starting under the age of 10 as Sandy did, can have profound effects on a child. It's a large responsibility that may bring various challenges. According to a study from the Journal of Adolescent Health, young caregivers often experience emotional stress and reduce social and extracurricular activities. Sandy adored his brother and sister, and despite assuming the role of babysitter, he was very responsible in his young age. Sandy was an inherently good child. He was quite shy, which unfortunately resulted in him having a limited social circle once he began elementary school. His introversion and lack of social skills was a byproduct of his homebound lifestyle, having to constantly babysit his siblings. When Sandy managed to have some personal time, he enjoyed immersing himself in the worlds of science fiction movies and video games. His absolute favorite game was the classic action adventure, The Legend of Zelda on the original Nintendo. these imaginative realms served as a welcome distraction from his heavy home responsibilities, allowing him to escape to magical fantasies where he could wield swords and have powers. He became a great writer as well, who took creative influence from his Cree ancestry, his mother and grandparents' stories about premonitions, the occult, dream interpretations, and spirituality really drove him. Sandy had a knack for storytelling from his vast imagination, and in school he stayed to himself but had a cheery disposition and only spoke in short sentences. As he was growing up, his teachers described him as reserved in groups, but got along with others. By 1991, 10-year-old Sandy became obsessed with the 1989 supernatural B-rated horror film, Warlock. The plot takes place in the 17th century, where a witch hunter captures a powerful warlock who had committed unspeakable crimes against humanity. Sentenced to execution, the warlock made a desperate plea to Satan for help, invoking a dark ritual that allowed him to escape his fate. With immortality, the warlock found himself hunted relentlessly by witch hunters throughout the centuries. As the 20th century came around, the warlock realized that his only chance of survival lay in unlocking even darker powers. He delved into forbidden knowledge, seeking the elusive witch's Bible that held the key to revealing the true identity of God. With this book, the warlock believed he could transcend and ascend to become the Antichrist, to mutilate the innocent for his own amusement. The warlock's magical powers and ability to control evil demons appealed to Sandy, and it quickly became his favorite film. In the early 1990s, Sandy's mother Jean noticed that her son's behavior was becoming increasingly concerning. He would spend hours locked in his room, sitting cross-legged in the dark, and plagued by the sinister voices in his head that urged him to commit acts of self-harm and murder. Jean feared that the behavior change was a result of possible sexual abuse, but Sandy denied any history of abuse and refused to engage in any discussion on the matter further. As time went on, Sandy's depression only deepened. He purchased a Ouija board in a desperate attempt to communicate directly with the malevolent voices that haunted his mind. His thoughts turned to self-harm and suicide that seemed to consume him more and more with each passing day. Sandy was now 13 years old, an eighth grader who attended Churchill Community High School. He no longer had a smile on his face or his regular cheery disposition. He was dark and moody, as described by his teachers. Sandy's fascination with horror films and the occult paraphernalia had reached an alarming level for a child his age. His obsession with the film Warlock had him in a chokehold, where it became the only film he would watch on repeat. He introduced his best friend, 7-year-old William Martin, to the film, and they both fantasized over the plot to becoming wizards themselves. William Martin was born on April 10, 1987, into a poor single-parent family in La Ronge, Saskatchewan. He often found his meals by going to other friends' homes for dinner. William attended Pre-Cam Elementary School, where he would meet up with Sandy Charles and hang out afterwards. Sandy never really had friends his own age, as he gravitated towards younger children, as they were easier for him to get along with, and together they would play baseball in the park. William had a few friends besides Sandy. One was his 7-year-old cousin, Jonathan. Jonathan George Thimpson was born on December 30th, 1987. Jonathan was a cheerful and spirited child who delighted in showcasing his cheeky smile by proudly displaying his 2 missing front teeth whenever he could. When he and his friends played outside, Jonathan would always take the role of his idol Zorro, brandishing a makeshift sword and mask to protect his buddies from his imaginary villains. Although he was raised by his parents, Jonathan found himself falling asleep on the air mattress at his grandparents' home, a common occurrence in the neighborhood as many families lived in small homes. Jonathan and his cousin William were of the same age, and they attended the same elementary school. On the morning of Saturday, July 8, 1995, Sandy rendezvoused with William and revealed an extraordinary plan. Today was going to be the day that he would unlock the power of flight by performing a sacrificial act, just like in the movie Warlock. According to the film, to gain access to the witch's Bible, the warlock must perform a satanic ritual that involves using the fat of an unbaptized virgin male child to gain the ability to fly. Sandy and William had a plan, but they needed a sacrifice. That's when William mentioned his cousin, Jonathan. Sandy and William decided to invite Jonathan to play baseball and attack him during the game later that day. Before the murder, Sandy had to prepare. He had hidden a paring knife and an empty soup can with the label removed, placing them in the bushes outside of his house. In the afternoon, William and his cousin Jonathan showed up at Sandy's house as arranged. As they geared up to play baseball, William pointed out that they had no ball. Sandy then challenged Jonathan to find the ball in the bushes behind him, promising him a $10 reward. The offer was tempting for a 7-year-old in the 90s, and without a second thought, Jonathan eagerly accepted the challenge. As the three boys scoured the dense bushes behind the house, a demonic voice in Sandy's head urged him to carry out the sacrificial murder. Sandy extended his hands toward Jonathan and told him to come closer into the thicket, under the guise of asking him to smell his hands, claiming that they smelt like a skunk. Jonathan crawled over, pushing branches away from his face. Sandy swiftly approached Jonathan, seizing him by the head and spinning him around before enveloping his head from behind with his arms. In an attempt to snap Jonathan's neck, Sandy was caught off guard as Jonathan sunk his teeth into Sandy's middle finger, causing him to bleed. Reacting quickly, Sandy retrieved the hidden paring knife and began stabbing Jonathan 4 times in the head. It was the 5th stab that hit Jonathan's jugular neck vein. The sight of blood made Sandy recoil, while his accomplice William egged him on, taunting Jonathan and insisting that he deserved to die this way. Fueled by William's encouragement, Sandy drove the knife into Jonathan's left eye, exerting so much force that the blade snapped off from the handle. William was surprised that Jonathan kept fighting back, and he handed Sandy a glass bottle. Sandy smashed it over Jonathan's head and kept hitting him with the broken pieces. William reached over and grabbed a rock and gave it to Sandy. Using the 11-pound rock, Sandy repeatedly struck Jonathan over the head while William cheered him on. Despite the brutal beating, Jonathan remained alive but weakened, lying defenseless in the dirt. Eventually, Sandy resorted to suffocating 7-year-old Jonathan Thimpson by pressing his hands over his mouth and nose until he succumbed to asphyxiation. After the brutal attack, Sandy took off his blood-soaked shirt and instructed William to fetch a towel from inside the house. Using the towel, Sandy began to clean up the crime scene. During this, William had to remind Sandy that they had forgotten to gather the crucial ingredient for their satanic ritual to achieve flight: fat from an unbaptized virgin child. Sandy dashed into the house and grabbed a new knife from the kitchen. He came back out to Jonathan's body and proceeded to cut 15 strips of flesh from his calves, back, abdomen, and arms, being described as hacking at each piece in the novel Kids Who Kill. The chunks of fat were then put into an empty soup can and taken into Sandy's house. Sandy continued to heat the can of flesh over the stove to render the fat from the contents. He then poured the liquid fat into another soup can, hiding it underneath the stairs of his house. William Martin had gone home, and Sandy began cleaning up the bloody mess. On Sunday, July 9th, the day following the murder of Jonathan Thimpson, his mother, 23-year-old Cindy Thimpson, believed that her son was staying at his grandmother's house or a friend's house. Cindy reached out to everyone to find Jonathan's whereabouts. As hours passed by, she filed a missing persons report with the RCMP, or the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. The RCMP were slow to start the search for the missing boy, leading volunteers in town to put up missing person posters and go door to door asking for information. Among those who joined the search were the perpetrators themselves, Sandy Charles and William Martin. The next morning, on Monday, July 10th, Sandy woke up early to move Jonathan's body from behind his house to a different location a few houses down from his own, after William had warned him that the bushes behind his house was too easy to find and would implicate him. Throughout the day, the RCMP received multiple tips about Jonathan's whereabouts, including sightings on deserted highways and even in Prince Albert, a city 2.5 hours away. Each tip had to be investigated, which slowed down the search. At 1:15 p.m., the RCMP were questioning people who had last seen the missing boy, including Sandy Charles, who claimed he last saw Jonathan after he invited him and William to a baseball game in his backyard. He then told Corporal Len Carson that Jonathan threw a tantrum and stormed off. When police interviewed William Martin, he told the same events, which left the investigation open, and still no body was found. By July 11th, the community grew restless with the lack of progress in the case of the missing boy. Michelle Harding, the Métis Nation elected area director of Saskatchewan, took charge and organized her own search party. That afternoon, Corporal Len Carson returned to Sandy Charles' home to gather more information about what happened to Jonathan before he disappeared. Sandy recounted that during the baseball game, he accidentally hit the ball, striking Jonathan in the head, who then stormed off in anger around 3 p.m. that Saturday. He then led Corporal Carlson through the backyard to reenact the incident, avoiding the area where the murder took place. Despite the gravity of the situation, Sandy appeared happy and willing to cooperate with the officer. Around 7 p.m., the search party, which included one of Jonathan's relatives, discovered the partially decomposed body of the 7-year-old, located 100 yards from Jonathan's grandmother's house, 45 yards away from the original crime scene. Roseanne Adam, who resided next to the Charles household with her grandsons, recounted that during the 5 months she lived near Sandy Charles, she seldom witnessed the teenager venture outside. When Jonathan Thimpson's body was discovered, Roseanne described her experience of investigating the commotion after hearing people screaming, stating, quote, "When they found the body, people were screaming and yelling. I went down there, but they told me to go back. When I was coming back, I seen Sandy's mother, Jean, standing outside. I told her they found the body. Sandy was inside, and he turned up the record player full blast. His mom went back inside and closed the door." The body was found just 6 hours after Michelle Harding initiated the search. The locals criticized the local RCMP for their delayed response, particularly pointing out the possible negligence due to Jonathan Thimpson being of Aboriginal descent. A relative of Jonathan expressed frustration to Michelle Harding, questioning why their community was not seen as equally human in the eyes of others. Michelle Harding was also disgusted by the actions, but seen light in the situation. Now that the body was found, there was evidence to solve the case. Fire Chief Jay Lloyd observed the tension between the RCMP and the Aboriginal community, acknowledging the misplaced anger and sadness following the tragic event. He noted that people often direct their frustration towards the police, as they are the most visible targets for the emotions. In his opinion, the anger was understandable, but perhaps misdirected, stating, quote, "People are angry this happened, but they don't know where to focus their anger. The police are always the first, most obvious to focus the anger on." The RCMP, on the other hand, refuted the claims of negligence in their investigation. They maintained that they initiated an official investigation as soon as the missing persons report was filed by Jonathan's mother. The delay in organizing a search was attributed to the influx of tips suggesting that Jonathan Thimpson was still alive and sighted within the community. The RCMP emphasized the need to ensure that any search efforts would not compromise a potential crime scene, and they expressed concerns that uncoordinated search parties could inadvertently disturb or tamper the vital evidence before it could be properly secured. Forensic analysis promptly confirmed that the death of Jonathan Thimpson was a homicide, evident from the severely decomposed and mutilated state of the body. The brutality of the killing led to rumors circulating within the community, with some speculating that it was linked to a satanic cult ritual due to the extreme violence involved. The body was transported to Prince Albert, Saskatchewan for an autopsy, which took place on Wednesday, July 12th. The cause of death was determined to be excessive blood loss resulting from a skull fracture and a laceration to the jugular vein. On Thursday, July 13th, at 11:47 a.m., 14-year-old Sandy Charles was arrested at his residence and charged with the first-degree murder of 7-year-old Jonathan Thimpson. Sandy openly admitted to the crime, and forensic analysis identified Jonathan's dental impressions on Sandy's middle finger. The RCMP seized incriminating evidence from Sandy's home, including bloodstained clothing and towels, a knife, tongs, and a soup can containing the remains of Jonathan Thimpson. The information regarding 7-year-old accomplice William Martin is sparse because of his age. Since Sandy Charles was 14 years old and the ringleader, there is more information on him. The RCMP imposed this strict blanket ban on sharing details of this case with the public, and the aim was to keep information confidential to protect the underage children involved. There was a community meeting organized by the RCMP and the Lac La Ronge Indian Band to address the case and dispel rumors of a murderous satanic cult, which, of course, only fueled public skepticism. The community started accusing the RCMP of neglecting the search for Jonathan due to his heritage, and this was a claim that the RCMP would deny. They assured the community of their safety, labeling the incident as an isolated incident, and they emphasized that the suspects were already in custody. But because of the blanket ban, they weren't allowed to disclose who the people were, especially because they were children under the age of 15. So the community is at a heightened tension, and they're upset with the authorities' discretion. The community started targeting Jonathan Thimpson's mother, Cindy, and his grandmother for not realizing that Jonathan was missing quicker than they did. Because what ended up happening was Jonathan didn't come home, and Cindy assumed that he was at his grandmother's house. This is the 90s. You were safe to assume that in a small town, your kid didn't go missing. Where your kid went was they're either at a friend's house or they're at their grandparents' house because everyone lived in a close-knit community. This isn't nowadays where there's cell phones and you can just give someone a text. I mean, to be fair, you could pick up a phone and give them a call. However, no one was concerned at this point. And it was because of that lack of concern is why when they didn't have the names of the perpetrators, they were looking for someone to get mad at. So they were getting mad at Jonathan Thimpson's mother for not taking better care of her child and where he was before he went missing. The community pointed out that it took 29 hours before his grandmother and mother reported the incident. Meanwhile, there were those who acknowledged the general lack of trust in the RCMP and that this may have prevented Cindy and the grandmother from reporting him sooner. There was also documentation that Cindy and her family had issues with the law before. But what Jonathan's mother, Cindy, and grandmother, Lydia, repeatedly defended was that they both believed Jonathan was at the other's home. Afterwards, they asked around where others claimed to have seen Jonathan around town, which at the same time was happening to the police. There was all these sightings of Jonathan, so no one believed that he was dead or missing. The police even said that one of the reasons why they didn't start a manhunt was because they had people calling them saying that Jonathan was alive and that they had seen them. Jonathan's grandmother revealed how she suffered from sleepless nights and nightmares from the news of her grandson's death. Many parents were terrified at the fact that their children played or went to school with either of the killers. The local church stated, quote, "That's not supposed to happen. Children are not supposed to kill children. Something is very wrong," end quote. The adults in the community, they begin taking notice of the mental health of adults and children in their community. A mental health worker named Jackie Ballantyne, she recalled that previously an 8-year-old girl had committed suicide due to a rough life. 8-year-old girl. Let's just let that sink in, Fear Cult. Many felt that what transpired was due to years of collective neglect of adults turning their backs on troubled children in their community. The community was devastated, and Jonathan's daycare classmates, they struggled to understand what happened to him. His seat was empty, and he was no longer attending classes, and parents have to explain this as best as they can to the children. So the supervisor explained that students were crying. Jonathan's friend group, they cried every day after learning what happened, and another young girl was crying nonstop. You can see how the murder of Jonathan Thimpson just affected the entire community. When everyone came together and had a memorial, they let balloons in Jonathan's memory into the sky. And at that moment, it started to rain. And a little child commented on how the raindrops were Jonathan's tears. Mercy me. Okay, Jonathan's nephew, 11-year-old Paul Thimpson, he remembered how just days before Jonathan's murder, he had seen Sandy Charles teasing him. And Paul stood up and told Sandy to leave Jonathan alone. His grandmother also recalls seeing Jonathan crying outside with Sandy nearby before his murder. Community members were interviewed by the authorities regarding Sandy's behavior over the summer, and many agreed that he started acting strange whenever he was out of the house. Here's an example. A father mentioned that 5 days before the murder of Jonathan, Sandy Charles and William Martin were caught attempting to lure his young daughter into the bushes with chocolate, which was discovered to be X-lax. The father had this to say. Sandy was planning to kill someone for a long time. He wanted attention, and I strongly believe that he was trying to kill my children. One of them, at least. My kids were easy pickings. End quote. The community of LaRange was divided into those who felt pity for Sandy and those who wanted to hurt him for what he had done. Those who felt charitable towards Sandy and William, they thought that he needed love. And a teacher and a member of the Concerned Parents group said, "One child dead, but the other is dying inside." This case confused those who knew Sandy personally because, quote, "he was not your stereotypical tattooed punk hanging out in the pool hall," end quote. Now here at the Fear Cult, we know that appearance doesn't mean a whole lot when it comes to cases. Or as I like to say, the Bundy syndrome. I mean, Albert Fish. He kidnapped, he sexually assaulted, and cannibalized children, and he utilized the guise of a sweet old man. And it was that allowed him to lure his victims in. Another one, 10-year-old Mary Bell. She was practically a cute little doll who giggled in interviews after she murdered 2 preschool boys. It would be considered naive to make assumptions about an individual's capacity for violence based solely on their outward appearance. I mean, Fear Cult, if there is anything that we have learned from studying true crime, it is that the external presentation of a person, including their age, does not necessarily provide an accurate reflection of their internal thoughts, their emotions, and their capabilities. There are human beings who possess the ability to conceal their true intentions and emotions, and it makes it an unreliable gauge to see their potential for violence purely based on superficial characteristics. A more logical approach is considering an individual's actions, their behaviors, and past experiences, because this is essential for a more accurate assessment of their possible violent progression. So when you look at Sandy's behavior and how he became openly dark and he was reclused, which was noticed by his teachers and even his mother, and these were the same people who noticed that he probably needed help, but they never asked him about it. And that's where talking to your children is very important. There were community members who admitted feeling guilty because they were silent as they watched Sandy struggle at home. Others ridiculed Sandy's mother, Jean Charles, for being neglectful because she became resentful to those who blamed her as she blamed herself. Jean said, quote, "I do blame myself. Sometimes I feel responsible. I feel if I would have been there every day, it wouldn't have happened. But I have to work. I'm a single parent, and I don't want welfare. It's like living under someone else's roof." End quote. Jean started to isolate herself after the murder inside of her home, and she was trying to rebuild her life. Remember, she has two other younger children. She visited Aboriginal spiritualists to help ease her pain, and she had plans to enroll in a business management course at university and turn her life around for her family. Jean stated that her son's actions left an embarrassment on the community, and she is aware that the Cree shun murderers. She knew that even if Sandy was released, he would never be welcomed back into his Aboriginal community. And Sandy later would comment that he had no plans to return. He knew what he did was wrong. As said before, the murder greatly affected the town, and this next part kills me. After the death of Jonathan Thimpson, the children of this community were asked to partake in a sponsored essay contest. The topic was, what do you feel you need the most? And a large majority of the children said that they needed their parents to be sober. Others wrote that they wanted their parents to be there for them. Children need love. They need to know that there is somebody there to support them in family and friends, to have this healthy upbringing so they can pass it on, not repeat cycles of abuse. So it's very important to talk to children and make them know that they are heard. So if you're sitting there right now thinking about how much you love your kids, pause this, go up to them, give them a big squeeze and let them know that they are loved and you love them because, well, some of them might just take it, but others might push you in and go, ew, gross, mom, dad, gross. But then that's when you gotta squeeze them harder and go, I'm doing this because I love you and I care about you. Cute. And then you start whipping out all the baby pictures and then it just becomes this big nostalgia fest. It could be a good time. Who knows? My point is, tell your kids that you love them and show your kids you love them. Now we are moving on to the trial of Sandy Charles. Let's continue. In November 1995, 14-year-old Sandy Charles was remanded to determine if he would be tried as an adult for the first-degree murder of 7-year-old Jonathan Thimpson. The Young Offenders Act at the time prohibited the public identification of both Sandy Charles and his 8-year-old accomplice, William Martin. The trial commenced the following summer, on June 18, 1996, in an adult court in Saskatoon. Judge Jerry Albright of the Court of Queen's Bench was tasked with deciding the fate of Sandy Charles without a jury. He had to determine if Sandy was guilty of first-degree murder, manslaughter, or not guilty by reason of insanity, with a potential sentence of 25 years in prison if found guilty of murder in the first degree. Sandy Charles entered a plea of not guilty due to mental incapacity. Both defense lawyer Barry Singer and public prosecutor Robin Ritter agreed that Sandy had committed murder. The main point of argument lay in whether Sandy Charles was sound of mind at the time of the crime. Ritter contended that Sandy was aware of his actions, while Singer argued that Sandy was in a delusional state during the incident, stating, quote, "A person operating normally could not do this. It's so bizarre. If he isn't entitled to this defense of reduced mental capacity, I don't know who is." When Sandy explained the mutilation of the body to the court, he explained that it was to attain the powers of flight, but he denied consuming any of the rendered body fat, saying that he didn't want to consume it. He just wanted to stay the way he was. The defense team argued that their client's challenging upbringing made him more vulnerable to the influence of horror films. His fascination with the occult, Ouija boards, and the paranormal, they suggested, led to Sandy's increased psychotic episodes. After watching the horror film Warlock, Sandy expressed his belief that he could become the son of Satan and acquire the power to fly. He only had to drink the boiled fat of an unbaptized virgin male child. While testifying, Sandy shared that he began hearing evil voices in his head when he was just 3 years old. He believed these spirits once lifted him from his bed and flung him across the room. They seemed to follow him and his family, moving with them to three different homes. Sandy even believed that Satan himself resided in his second house. By the time his family moved to their current residence in LaRange, he felt the presence of three distinct spirits, one in his brother's room, one in the basement, and one in his own bedroom. Sandy testified that he felt watched and heard the voices in his head. When Sandy described the murder further, he shared that his partner in crime, William Martin, convinced him to hide the body post-murder. According to Sandy, it was William who showed more interest in consuming the fat to gain the ability to fly. He noted that William seemed pleased at the sight of Sandy attacking Jonathan. Sandy's mother, Jean, when called to the stand, confessed her inability to recognize her own son due to his drastic personality change. She expressed her distress to the judge, saying, quote, "He said he couldn't stop himself. He said it was like a dream. He didn't want to do it, but it was like he wasn't doing it." Both the defense and prosecution teams brought in psychiatrists to deliver expert testimonies. The defense had collaborated with Dr. Graham Terrell, a Toronto-based psychiatrist who had examined Sandy Charles earlier that year. Dr. Terrell determined that Sandy had personality disorders and a delusional condition that he had developed gradually. He stated there was a gradual, slow, and insidious deterioration of mental faculties that accumulated with this episode, referring to the time of the murder. Dr. Terrell testified Sandy Charles suffered from a severe mental disorder, causing him to lose touch with reality during the murder. He suggested that Sandy only began to grasp the gravity of his actions when Jonathan started bleeding from his wounds. Despite Sandy's delusions, Dr. Terrell warned the court of his dangerous potential, recalling Sandy's own words, "I don't know what I was thinking. I really did not want to hurt him, but I killed him." A second defense psychiatrist, Dr. Robert Wood Hill, agreed with Dr. Terrell's assessment. He stated that Sandy was in a delusional state when he began to kill Jonathan and only recognized the crime when blood was spilt. Even then, his delusion compelled him to continue, preventing him from fully grasping reality as a typical person would. Despite being an excellent student and earning silver medals in school, Sandy only scored 78 on an administered IQ exam, placing him on the borderline of being mentally impaired. Dr. Terrell supported Sandy's insanity plea, explaining how Sandy had fixed false beliefs that posed high risk of reoffending. Sandy retreated into a delusional fantasy world that provided him with a sense of normalcy. Sandy admitted he believed that drinking Jonathan's rendered fat would give him the ability to fly, even though he had no desire to do so. The psychiatrist also suggested that it was possible for Sandy, who was only 14 at the time, to have been influenced into committing murder by his 8-year-old accomplice, William Martin. RCMP officers testified that Sandy told them it was William who instructed him to move the body the following day, and even suggested that he take the heart, which Sandy refused. During Dr. Terrell's cross-examination by the prosecution, he was asked if he believed Sandy would have killed Jonathan Thimpson if a police officer was nearby. Dr. Terrell believed that Sandy would not have, as an officer represented an adult authority figure. Prosecution Robin Ritter pointed out that this suggested Sandy knew his actions were wrong. Ritter continued his argument by noting that Sandy had asked the RCMP, quote, "What happens if I planned everything from the start? If I planned everything, do I go to jail longer?" Sandy had admitted to the RCMP that he wanted to break Jonathan's neck because he didn't know how to use a knife. The court was informed that Sandy Charles told the youth jail staff that he hopes to be declared insane so he could be sent to a psychiatric hospital and released within 2 years. While in the prisoner's box, Sandy exhibited distracting behavior, like playing with his hair, scraping his nails on the desk, making snarling noises, and tapping his feet. He even yawned loudly during the prosecution's arguments, seemingly indifferent to the proceedings. The prosecution's expert psychiatrists contested the notion that Sandy was delusional at the time of the murder. Dr. Renee Fitzpatrick suggested that Sandy was in the early stages of schizophrenia, requiring treatment, also remarking on the unusualness of someone as young as Sandy having the brain chemical imbalance that leads to schizophrenia. Dr. Fitzpatrick emphasized the need to evaluate Sandy's psychological and social needs, social skills, and empathy levels. Another prosecution psychiatrist, Dr. Robin Menzies, expressed that in his 2 decades of career, Sandy's psychosis was a new experience to him. He expressed that Sandy was suffering from 2 unusual forms of delusions, indicative of schizophrenia. Dr. Menzies stated, quote, "I have seen thousands of psychotic people, with one exception. I have never seen a psychosis like this one." The doctor further clarified that Sandy's delusions were not the driving force behind the murder, that most deluded people never act on their beliefs, but rather talk about committing them. Typically, individuals who commit murder under such delusions believe they are protecting or assisting others, commonly referred to as a mission killer. Sandy Charles, however, did not display any emotional investment in the murder. The prosecution's experts believe that Sandy enjoyed the notoriety he gained at the detention center prior to the trial, a belief asserted by workers at the center that he talked obsessively about the murder and was proud. Dr. Menzies added that William Martin was the primary influence during the premeditated murder. If William hadn't been there to supply the weapons and encouragement, the murder may not have happened. The fact that Sandy had lured Jonathan Thimpson into an isolated location indicated the desire to avoid being caught. It was revealed that Dr. Menzies interviewed Sandy and explained that he diagnosed him as mentally ill, which only made Sandy smile. It was acknowledged that Sandy wanted others to think he was crazy, so he was sent to a hospital and not prison. Sandy expressed concern about being raped in prison. When defense lawyer Barry Singer asked Dr. Robin Menzies whether Sandy's diagnosed schizophrenia could disrupt his ability to distinguish right from wrong, Dr. Menzies stated, quote, "Just because a person is having a delusion or hallucination doesn't mean his cognitive ability is knocked off. Mental illness comes in different degrees. In the sort of degree Mr. Charles has, it is not a severe degree, and I think that he has to be held accountable for his behavior, despite the fact that he has a mental illness." When approached for comment on the impact of their 1989 film Warlock on Sandy Charles, the producers and writers defended themselves by stating that they create fictional stories for entertainment purposes. They emphasize that no one believes Spider-Man or Superman's abilities are real. Viewers should not take their movies as reality, that no one watches Spider-Man and thinks they can climb a wall, or that after watching Superman they can learn how to fly. Thus, they reject any accusations of being directly responsible for the tragic death of Jonathan Thimpson, and viewers should not take their movies as reality. The trial lasted for 7 days, during which 3 out of 4 psychiatric experts agreed that Sandy Charles was suffering from schizophrenia, while the 4th believed he was affected by grandiose delusions. However, there was a division among the experts on whether his mental illness prevented him from understanding the wrongfulness of his actions. On August 2, 1996, Sandy Charles was found not guilty by reason of insanity. The judge determined that his mental disorder rendered him incapable of appreciating the nature or quality of his actions, and therefore could not be held criminally responsible. This verdict left Jonathan Thimpson's mother, Cindy, feeling frustrated and believing that Sandy Charles had escaped justice. She expressed her dissatisfaction with the ruling, stating her belief that he should have been convicted of first-degree murder. She also expressed her desire to have the decision appealed, stating, quote, "I think he knew what he was doing when he did it. What he did. I don't think he was sick when he did it. I really don't think so. I think he should have got convicted of first-degree murder. I'm interested in having it appealed." Despite Cindy's wishes, the courts chose not to appeal the ruling, maintaining that Sandy Charles was indeed suffering from a mental disorder. Sandy's mother, Jean Charles, struggled with the difficult task of facing Cindy Thimpson to offer an apology. It took Jean 5 months to gather the courage to do so, as she was shaken to the core and could barely remember her words, except for expressing that no mother should have to endure the pain of losing a child in such a tragic manner. The community continued to blame Jean Charles for the actions of her son, labeling her as a neglectful mother who failed to involve her children in the community. A local indigenous medicine woman counseled Sandy Charles months after the murder, expressing her belief that Sandy would never be accepted back into the community. She stated, "If we follow our traditional ways, we don't judge each other. We leave it to the Creator. But if someone has taken a life, in traditional society, they were banished." Jackie Ballantyne, a member of the Native Women's Council, highlighted the issue of neglected boys, like Sandy in all communities, emphasizing the need for guidance and parental presence in children's lives. She remarked, "Kids need guidance. They need to know their parents are going to be there to protect and keep them safe. That little boy was trying to find his own power and to know that he mattered." End quote. Other community members expressed their intention to move if Sandy was ever released and returned to LaRange. The elders pointed out that even if he were cured, according to traditional Cree ways, when there was no law, he would not be allowed to come back out of fear of potential harm. A way of keeping the community and himself safe. Following the trial, Sandy Charles was sent to Saskatchewan Hospital in North Battleford for post-psychiatric evaluation. Subsequently, he was transferred to Sills Apps Treatment Center in Oakville, Ontario, specializing in teenagers. He spent 70 days at the treatment center, costing Canadian taxpayers $38,000, Authorities thought it would be prudent to leave Sandy in the Ontario Center, but the cost of $500 a day was too much to sustain the treatment indefinitely. Therefore, Sandy was sent back to Saskatchewan Hospital. The Mental Health Review Board would assess Sandy every 6 months and assess his treatment. By 16 years old, Sandy was prescribed antipsychotic drugs. His mother, Jean, tried to visit, but the entire time Sandy ignored her and pretended that she wasn't there. Sandy would display reluctance to engage in rehabilitation programs and interviews, showing no signs of hallucinations or delusions that led him to the tragic event in 1995. While incarcerated, he would make concerning statements to his roommates, suggesting that he wanted to cut up other bodies. During discussions with the review boards, Sandy displayed a mix of positive rehabilitation outlook and disturbing remarks. Psychiatrists expressed concern about his environment. He was surrounded by adults, and Sandy refused to interact with Cree elders or other teenagers. Dr. Fitzpatrick noted his deep depression, stating, quote, "He is very depressed. There is no light at the end of the tunnel for him. He needs to be in one place for 4 to 5 years to establish some sort of attachment somewhere." After careful consideration, the Mental Health Review Board determined that it was in society's best interest for Sandy Charles to remain at Saskatchewan Hospital. Sandy was under the impression that he was only ever going to be incarcerated for 2 years, and he bragged about it to his roommates. And as 1998 rolls around, he's 17 years old, and he's mad that he's still on remand. One afternoon, on March 30th, 1998, he's out for a walk in the gardens with his psychiatrist, and this was routine activity for him. He wasn't a troublemaker. Sandy was like, "Oh, I need to tie my shoe." And he bent down, and then he bolted towards the forest nearby. Now, what I'm able to get from this was that they were on like a golf course, an inmate kind of golf course location, so there wasn't fences where they were, which wasn't good because he basically was like a dog when they get out of their collar and then they think it's a game and he just took off. So despite being trusted to roam this garden area, he managed to elude the RCMP for 15 hours before being apprehended and returned back to the hospital. Following this incident, his outdoor privileges were revoked for only 7 months. He was afterwards allowed to go back to routine, but he had to wear a satellite tracking device. The hospital officials issued a statement, and they acknowledged that despite the rehabilitative approach in psychiatry, the degree of risk always remains. Sandy was then transferred from a minimum security facility to a maximum security regional psychiatric center in Saskatoon. So in this new setting, residents were housed without windows, they had concrete cells, and they had no views outside or any natural light. Let's hop, skip, and a jump a couple years here. It's now June 2000, and Sandy was 17 years old, and he found himself back in court for assaulting a prison nurse. So as a result, he was sentenced to a day in solitary confinement. Throughout his time in custody, Sandy has primarily been at the Saskatchewan Regional Psychiatric Center, or RPC. Now, the RPC, it functions as a hybrid institution, and it serves both as a psychiatric hospital and a penitentiary with maximum security measures. However, back in 2013, Sandy was moved back to the hospital in North Battleford. Following some behavioral changes, Sandy was eventually transferred back to RPC, maximum security, and a spokesperson from Saskatchewan Hospital emphasized the importance of following strict institutional guidelines for success within their facility to help Sandy Charles. During a review board meeting, psychiatrists examined Sandy about his readiness for his transition to be relocated to Saskatchewan Hospital and how he had plans to adapt to the adjustment. Sandy acknowledged his ongoing efforts to address his behavioral issues, particularly struggling with anger, and noted that his attempts to engage more with fellow inmates so he can have his eventual reintegration into society. However, the introduction of Bill C-54 by the Harper government, it proposed a stricter regulation for violent offenders found not criminally responsible. And this would prolong their institutionalization and giving the victims' families more input in the process. Now, despite this, the Schizophrenia Society of Canada reported that a vast majority, between 93 and 95% of released individuals in this category, do not reoffend. A spokesperson for the society criticized the federal government's approach, accusing them of prioritizing political gains over justice in society. Sandy is starting to look forward to potentially relocating back to Saskatchewan Hospital, and the debate over the treatment of individuals found not criminally responsible, it just continues. So as far as public information goes, it's now 2024, and 43-year-old Sandy Charles is still not eligible for release anytime soon, meaning he hasn't shown the appropriate signs to be reintegrated into society. As for Sandy's accomplice, William Martin, his life and treatment are unknown due to the media blackout, and his current whereabouts are also unknown. The tragic case of Jonathan Thimpson underscores the importance of early intervention in children's mental health. Sandy Charles, diagnosed with schizophrenia, attributed his crimes to voices he believed pleased Satan. His isolation from family left him feeling lonely, and he was unsure of how to seek help, leading to escalating darkness within his emotions. Sandy told the courts that the spirits were telling him to harm himself and others at a very early age, saying, quote, "I started to think about killing. Something wanted me to, and I felt like somebody was watching me. I believed it was Satan. I felt like killing myself sometimes, and when I would go in my room, and when I slept, I get all these thoughts about becoming evil, and there's a strong spirit in my room that gave me these thoughts." That was the case of Sandy Charles and his 8-year-old accomplice, William Martin. I was very shocked that I had no awareness of this case, especially since I'm Canadian and Saskatchewan is the province directly neighboring me. As for where Sandy is today, I think it's safe to assume that he's still locked up because no updates have been given on his sentence and there is no news of his accomplice, William Martin, because he was too young. Regardless, that is a lesser known case for you, Fear Cult. I'm currently working on a Fear Cult most requested case, and it will be a worst of the worst analysis, so get ready for that. It's going to be a two-parter, possibly a three-parter. You never know where research takes you.
There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now, and then they'll come for you.
Returning to our never-ending quest to find a truly scary movie, I am recommending two films because I'm feeling spicy. First is the 2004 Chinese cross-cultural horror titled Three Extremes. This is an anthology and it contains three brutal, powerful horror stories by three of Asia's top directors. I love anthologies and I love foreign films! The second movie has won 45 awards. And it is the 2008 Swedish vampire horror film, Let the Right One In. Oh, don't confuse the recommended original Swedish version I just said with the American 2010 version titled Let Me In. The plot of Let the Right One In, 2008, it's a fragile, anxious boy, 12-year-old Oscar. He's regularly bullied by his stronger classmates and he never strikes back. Then the boy finds a friend. This friend, who is also 12, moves in next door to him. Then all of these deaths start happening, and Oscar realizes that his new friend is a vampire, and his friendship with her is stronger than his fear. It's fantastic introducing people to foreign films if they haven't seen them. They're harder to locate, but they're so worth it because it's a different element of fear. And if it's taboo, they go there. Foreign films do not mess around. You can visit lullabythefearpodcast.com for the full list of previous never-ending quest films, and the trailer links are there as well. So follow Lullaby the Fear Podcast on Instagram and Threads for more episode updates. So thank you for listening to this week's lullaby. Sweet dreams. Lights out.